Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, a Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. On April 18th and April 19th, Fidelity Investments Canada hosted Focus 2024, a two-day event for advisors featuring insights from Fidelity's portfolio managers and subject matter experts. For today's podcast, we're bringing you a discussion from this event featuring portfolio manager Connor Gordon, who co-manages Fidelity's Global Small Cap Opportunities Fund with Chris Maladzinski. Connor sits down with host Pat Boland to discuss the fund, which launched in 2022. Today, we'll hear how the fund is managed, how it applies a go-anywhere approach and seeks the best investment opportunities around the world and is not confined to any specific regions. Connor adds strong security selection is his primary asset in his arsenal and elaborates on the process and how he picks and views stocks. Today's podcast was recorded on April 18th, 2024.
I thought Andrew Marchese said something interesting this morning. I felt for you a little bit because he said small business is going to be under fire. You're not under fire. Most small caps are underperforming large cap. How are you doing?
Yeah, look, I think, often we get asked, small caps as an asset class, right? And it actually touches on a point that Andrew made this morning, which is, leadership in the market. And, I'm a big believer that you can, study history, observe the present, and try and anticipate the future. So talking about leadership, what leads the market? Okay, go back to the 1960s. You had the Nifty 50 growth stocks, right? The 1970s, you had energy. 1980s was Japan. 1990s was TMT, right? 2000s, China, emerging markets, commodities. And basically, for the last 10 to 12 years, you've had nothing but, U.S. large cap growth stocks, tech stocks in particular. So, when we think about leadership, I think you need to prepare for the possibility, given that history, that tech stocks and growth stocks aren't the ones that are going to be leading, the next bull market. Within that, I think, how are we doing it? The whole point of having a global small cap fund is that we can go anywhere. It is a, everyone wants to talk about the stock market. It is a market of stocks. And, when we are trying to put together, a balanced, concentrated portfolio, right? The bulk of our risk tends to be in the top 40 to 50 stocks, right? And then we'll have a tail of positions. But, if Chris and I are looking across the world, hopefully we can go and find a best ideas portfolio, between the two of us that puts together 40 to 50 great ideas and can generate, great returns for clients, regardless of what happens to be going on in the macro environment.
For those that haven't bought any yet in the advisor community, what would you say to them? Why should they buy now?
Yeah, look, I think it's exactly that point, right? I think leadership. So, prepare for the possibility that what has worked might not be what works in the future. So I think if you look at our fund, what does that mean? It means, go global versus just the U.S. It means look at small caps versus just large caps. And it looks maybe you should be looking at things outside of tech. And when you look at our exposure over time, historically, that has been something like 75%-ish in consumer, industrials, and financials. So we can be a great diversifier to what I think is typically a core allocation in a client portfolio of, Canadian and U.S. equities. And then we have demonstrated that we don't need to be in the asset class, right? I think people want to talk about indices, and I think there's a whole lot of bad things about passive indices, particularly in the small cap space, right? You just take the Russell 2000. Well, 30 to 40% of companies in that index are unprofitable. It's not what we do, right? Our fund looks a lot different than what, a typical passive index might look like. So I think we can go, anywhere. We can generate, be that diversifier and be that return enhancer for a client portfolio.
It's amazing. When people think of small cap, they think of, ma and pa garage kind of small cap. The micro caps that Solomon. You actually have some pretty big companies.
Yeah, I think, global small cap, right? People think, global. Well, that sounds exotic. Small cap, that sounds risky.
Right.
And I think what we need to do is kind of, get rid of some of that misperception. So if you look at us, typically we have been 60 to 70% in North America, right? So our view is start at home and then pick off best ideas in the European market, in Japan, right? Go, use our global universe, an unconstrained opportunity set to really go and find best of breed ideas, regardless of where they happen to be headquartered. The second point is, you know, small cap.
Right.
If you're in Canada, and I spend a lot of time in Canadian small caps as an analyst, you know, you're probably thinking, okay, like $100, $200 million junior miner, oil and gas company, right? That is not what we do, right? We, you know, speculative tech company or biotech company, it's not what we do. The average market cap of our fund is about $7 billion US, right? So I think we need to, you know, reprogram that to say, you know, in a global small cap in a Canadian context, ends up being more like a mid cap, right? So a lot less risky than what people typically perceive a small cap to be. And, you know, I think then we kind of layer that on, right? We're not doing these, you know, cyclical things like, you know, oil and gas or mining or very speculative technology. It is really, okay, big, profitable, proven companies, but ones that still have a lot of runway to continue to grow and compound capital shareholders.
You said a dangerous word in the investment world, risky. Are small caps riskier than large caps?
I think, look, we're always, you know, what do we do? So one of the ways, there's a few ways you can manage risk within a portfolio. And, you know, the first one that we focus on is security selection. So I can't control the stock quote, but I can control what we buy. And what we buy, you know, are we tend to focus on things that are higher quality businesses. And if you are buying higher quality businesses, I can't guarantee that they aren't going to go down this month, this quarter, this year. But the whole point is avoid digging holes. Right. If you buy high quality businesses where the intrinsic value is growing over time, you tend not to dig very big holes. And if you can avoid digging holes for yourself, you can reduce the risk in the portfolio. The second thing we do is position size. So if you ask most portfolio managers, how do you size your positions? Yeah, 99% of them will say, I do it based on conviction. Wrong way to do it, in my opinion. Okay. We flip it around. We start with a risk budget. How much can we lose, right? So we want to have a defined risk budget for every security in the portfolio. So when we're then, what does that mean? Okay, if we want to limit our loss on any specific security to call it 100 basis points, when we were doing our upside downside scenario, right? And we think, okay, in a you know, bad case, we're going to lose 30%, rough numbers, right? Well, guess what? That position is never going to be more than 3% of the portfolio, right? We want to really isolate that the risk budget for every stocks, that when we are wrong, because we are going to be wrong, everyone is going to be wrong, that we really mitigate the impact on the total portfolio. And the third thing is portfolio construction, right? And I think every quarter, you know, we sit down with our CIO, Andrew Marchese, as well as our head of risk, John Wilson, and, you know, we go through the deck. And I think one of the things that you learn, you know, as you move from analyst to portfolio manager is, okay, every stock is a puzzle piece. But how do those pieces go together, and how you construct that portfolio is how it dictates how that portfolio will perform under different circumstances. So we're always trying to, what we do is isolate the idiosyncratic factors and try and avoid making implicit bets on factor, geography, or sector. When you look at our returns, we want those returns to be a function of the idiosyncratic stock selection, not making a factor bet or a style bet or a big bet on a sector or geography, right? Stay down the middle. Do what we do best, which is idiosyncratic stock selection.
You keep saying we, and we should talk about the relationship you have with Chris, and I'm known for booting names, Melodzinski. How'd they do?
Close.
Okay, good. You guys started together as analysts.
Yeah, so I started, so we both started on the Canadian research team, which, you know, many of you probably know, when you join the Canadian research team, you become a sector analyst. So you will get, you get given a sector, and you'll know that sector for 3-4 years. You'll know it inside and out, and then you get a new sector, right? And the whole point being, you know, after maybe 10, 12 years, you've got really good broad industry knowledge to then, you know, be able to go out and pick stocks across the portfolio. So Chris and I have been working together for 15 years, the last five of which formally as co-portfolio managers on the strategy. And, you know, I think credit to this partnership really needs to go to Andrew, who, you know, kind of thought up this, you know, in middle of 2018, he came to us and said, we think there's an opportunity. So I had, you know, we had taken these divergent career paths. I had covered industrials, tech, healthcare, and then kind of taken a bit of a detour and became a generalist on some of the small cap products that the group has. And Chris had kind of done the opposite. He had done consumer, he had done financials, and he'd done mining. And the whole point was, okay, you've been working together for 10 years. You are style consistent. You look at the market in the same way. You're already sharing ideas already. Let's put you together. And then you have almost, you know, 100% coverage of the sector as analysts. Put you together. Use a big, have that big global universe, unlimited universe, in an inefficient asset class, small caps, to try and generate, you know, a nice balanced, concentrated, best ideas portfolio.
Okay, so then do you stick to your rails in terms of each of you sitting, the sectors you are, or I guess really walk me through the selection process. What do you do?
Look, we each have, you know, the ability to pull the trigger. I think one thing we do, we call it, certain, you know, spheres of influence. So it's exactly that, right? You know, Chris has deep experience and deep sector knowledge in consumer, real estate, insurance, right? Things that I don't have necessarily insurance or experience with. But, you know, we tend to, you know, like, again, sphere of influence, stick to our knitting. But one thing that's great about having a co-managed fund is you get to be devil's advocate. Right. So when I, you know, when I am looking at an idea, I get to bounce it off Chris. You know, do you see anything here, right? Is anything look, you know, any risks that I can't see that you might see, right? And I think that ultimately, when you have that co-managed fund, you have two sets of eyes that are often looking at positions and criticizing positions, you get to a better answer, right? I think that's the whole point, is it's all about the numbers. We just want to get there and do so in a balanced way. And I think when you take that sector expertise, and kind of going back to what I've been talking about, balance, right? You have nice balance across the portfolio from a sector perspective as well.
Okay, so then, but still back to the selection process, how do you screen to get to those names that you're looking at, or do you screen?
Yeah, look, our strategy is, we call it inflection point investing. So we often get asked, are you growth investors, are you value investors? No, we're inflection point investors. So we invest in high quality companies that are undergoing an inflection point that allow us to underwrite earnings growth and multiple expansion. So let's unpack that a little bit. So, you know, quality. Quality to us means profitability, predictability, and growth. Three things. So profitability. We want companies that are high return on capital, that are free cash flow generative, and they're free cash flow generative today, right? We want profits today, not hope tomorrow. So when you look through our fund, you look at the holdings, you aren't going to find many, if any, unprofitable companies, right? That's by design. Number two, predictability. We want to be able to look out at least 3 years and have a pretty good idea of what a company's earnings power is going to look like. And it's very simple. If you can't predict what a company is going to earn, you can't value it. If you can't value it, you shouldn't invest in it, right? You're not investing, you're speculating. So we want to have a very, very well-defined view on what the earnings power of that business looks like 3 years from now. So what do? We tend to avoid things that are, you know, we don't really invest in, commodities, right? So mining, despite the fact that Chris covered mining, we don't really invest in mining that much.
Not that you wouldn't ever. It's
just... Not that we wouldn't ever, but, you know, in general, we want to avoid things that are hypercyclical, right? And I don't have a great view on, you know, what is the price of oil? What are the price of copper going to be, you know, 1, 2, 3, 5 years from now? I don't know. We can get exposure in different ways, but to commodities. But, you know, if, you know, just commodity prices in general, you know, specifically, it's not really something we do. Tech, despite the fact that I used to cover tech, you know, I think we've had roughly 10% or less tech exposure over the past, you know, 4.5 years. What are tech companies? You got very, very short product cycles, high obsolescence risk, right? I have, you know, wounds, you know, battle wounds from being the analyst that covered Research in Motion early in my career, right? And you can see, okay, you know, all of a sudden, like, how do you go? You know, I can still remember Mike Lazaridis and Jim Balsillie being on the cover of, I think it was Forbes or Fortune, you know, best, you know, most innovative, fastest growing company. And that was like 2008. And like, you know,
poof,
iPhone, poof, right? iPhone gets announced, you know, gets launched in 2007. You know, 3 years later, you know, the earnings power disappeared. And it's never recovered, right? And I think when you are on the wrong side of a technology cycle, you know, your business can disappear very, very quickly. So we tend not to invest a ton in tech. There's a few reasons for that. But again, just profitability, predictability, and then growth, right? Again, what I was saying, like, we don't want to dig holes for ourselves. So we want companies where, you know, time is our friend. Intrinsic value is growing, not shrinking. And we are kind of like, you know, speculating on whether or not someone is going to pay a higher price tomorrow. So profitability, predictability, and growth.
Okay.
And then I'm going to keep going.
Okay. Sure.
Because you asked, how do we screen? So the inflection point, right? The problem with a lot of quality companies is, you know, they're efficiently priced most of the time, right? If you invest in efficient markets, you get average returns. We're looking for extraordinary returns, so we need to find the exceptions. And you find the exceptions when there are inflection points. So inflection points can be structural, they can be cyclical, they can be idiosyncratic. Chris and I tend to focus on the idiosyncratic. So think of things like new products, management change, acquisitions, divestitures, changes, industry consolidation, changes in industry structure, turnarounds, things where we can look out and say, we have a different view. We have a differentiated view. The future looks different than the past, and we can isolate that mispricing. And I think that's a lot, a lot of words. I think examples tend to help on, what are we looking for, right? So if you look at our, our last disclosed top 10, we can talk about a couple stocks that are in there. One of them we often get asked is a company called Valvoline, right? And first thing that people probably think is, oh, Valvoline Motor Oil. That doesn't sound very good, right? And, I think you need to peel it back. Okay, yeah. So, Valvoline historically was a business that did, roughly 2/3 of the business was motor oil. And motor oil is not a great business, right? It's competitive, it's low margin, it's low growth. But they had another business. That was Quick Lubes, right? And that was about 1/3 of the business. So, think of like Jiffy Lube, Mr. Lube in Canada. And this is a great business, okay? This is a business that is competing against mom and pops, taking share. They are growing unit count, or have been growing unit count like 7, 8, 9% a year. Same store sales have been growing, 6, 7, 8% a year, right? So they've been compounding the earnings power of that business, 15-20%. And every year, talk about inflection point, right? It was like 20% of the business, and then it was 30% of the business. And we got to this point where all of a sudden it was going to go over 50%. And it was going to become the driver. And that was what people were going to pay attention to. We also had this thought, okay, what happens if they sell part of the business, right? And that's actually what happened. Saudi Aramco gave them a price they couldn't refuse on the motor products business, right? They paid $2.6 or $2.7 billion for the motor products business. And then what are we left with? We were buying this business that was compounding or had been compounding 15-20% a year at 14 times earnings. Sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah, no kidding. Okay, so then through the inflection point concept and quality and predictability and growth, you keep coming up with valuations.
Yes.
Describe the market right now in terms of your opportunity for valuations using those parameters.
The valuation parameter?
Against the basis of is there enough quality out there? Is there enough predictability?
Look, again,
valuations.
Market of stocks versus stock market. I'll address, directly, everyone talks about the market being expensive. I don't see it. So really? Large caps are expensive. Smid caps are not. If you look at forward estimates, smid caps are 15 times earnings. That is right in the middle of the historical average, right? So, whereas if you look at, S&P 500 or, the Mag 7, they are 20, 21 times earnings. Here's a great thing. Again, small caps, that 30, 40% premium that you're paying for large caps versus small caps, it's never been this big. You have to go back to 99, 2000, right? To get a valuation spread that big. So I think, the S&P 500, maybe it's picked over, but we find great ideas every single day. Right. And I don't think valuations are a headwind. Right. We can buy stocks that have good fundamentals trading at 12, 13, 14 times earnings. Right. Better businesses in the market at a discount to the market. When we find that, we're always interested.
Fidelity's hallmark is research. And they have all these rooms, floors and all that kind of jazz to meet companies when they come in.
Yep.
Do small caps come in and do you attend? Like, how much interaction do you actually have with management, especially in light of them being small caps?
I mean, I do a couple hundred company meetings a year.
A couple of hundred?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. So, often I'm hosting them. I was an analyst. I still have a deep need to look at the numbers, right? Do models, look at the numbers. And I often say there's narrative and there's numbers, right? And I think the thing you have to remember about, public company management teams, like CEOs in particular, is like, they're not just like the chief executive, they are the chief salesperson. So, and they're not only selling products, but they're selling their company to investors. And in general, people want to present their company in the best possible light. So one of our jobs is to peel back the onion and say, does the story I am being presented match up with the numbers that the company is reporting? So I like to say numbers versus narrative. And when the narrative and the numbers diverge, I focus on the numbers, not the narrative. Right? So, we're always looking to, what is the intrinsic value of the business? What is the price the market is willing to give me that stock at? And we get really excited when there's a big gap between that that price and value.
I think it's a go anywhere fund.
Yep.
Is it? Where are you finding yourself these days, geographically or otherwise?
So historically, as I said, we've been 60-70% in North America. And it's a really hard question to answer because I like to say the volatility creates dislocation. Dislocation creates mispricing. And I don't know where the volatility is going to come from, right? So I have a concept that I call old research, new events, right? Why do I do a couple hundred company meetings a year? Because you have to keep that Rolodex fresh, right? So, you know, we have a focus list called 500-600 companies that Chris and I have met over 15 years where we say, okay, we like the business. We like the management team. I just don't like the price. And that's always where we're waiting, right? That we're constantly reevaluating and kind of trying to find those inflection points and those mispricing opportunities to, you know, put them into the fund. So, you know, I can't tell you exactly where the opportunities are going to be because I don't know. But, you know, but here's an example, right? Macro example. You go back late 2022, right? Interest rates are starting to go up.
Yep.
Okay. Housing sells off. Okay. Well, there's an opportunity. So we start filtering through and, you know, you follow these companies and one of the stocks that's in the top 10 is a company called Installed Building Products. Boring name. But, you know, Installed Building Products, and it's a tongue twister. They do insulation installation. Okay. So doesn't sound like a great business. It's a wonderful business. Capital light, high return on capital. And they have basically been acquiring companies. If you look over the last, you know, several years, the management team has been putting capital to work, reinvesting their capital at like a high teens return on incremental capital. Okay. Well, guess what? People are afraid of, you know, the housing cycle, interest rates, stock trades down. And we get to buy a business that's, you know, compounding its value, high teens. I think we started buying at our 10 or 11 times earnings. Okay. So I don't know. The market is going to give you opportunities. I don't know where they're going to come from. But again, old research, new events, you have to act quickly. And if you haven't done the work, you can't take advantage of it.
So you're not strictly stocks up. You do take macro into consideration, waiting for those idiosyncratic events to happen.
I think you have to be macro aware. You have to be aware of what is going on in thematically or from a macro perspective, top down, industry down, to really pay attention. Because, like, you know, again, volatility creates dislocation. Dislocation creates mispricing, and those macro events they can create. Again, another one, like, you know, a huge area that we had in COVID. Were consumer companies, right? So, okay, COVID, what happened? Retailers, restaurants, they are literally locked down. Revenues are zero. Like, I can remember being on the phone. I was on the phone with Hugo Lavallee on a company, you know, called Five Below at the time, which is the, you know, quasi dollar store, dollar retailer. And, you know, when you're talking to the CFO about how much cash they have on the balance sheet to, you know, to survive, like how many months can they survive when your stores are closed, you're making no revenue, that is a macro dislocation, right? And those are, you know, that is an example of a macro-driven mispricing. But it's macro, but ultimately it comes down to what are the fundamentals, right? How is the macro or how are the industry-level trends driving the fundamental earnings power of the business? That's what we're always focused on. Focus on the earnings power to try and see through the macro uncertainty, okay? Because I can't base my investment strategy on what Jerome Powell may or may not say at the next meeting. We want to focus on what is the earnings power, what is that doing kind of 3-5 years from now? And if the market wants to hand us an opportunity in the short term, we can look through that uncertainty and take advantage.
You know, it's interesting. I'm going to come back to the small cap focus, if you will, because when I look through your top 10, it's not as though these are names I don't recognize. Valvoline is a good example of that.
Yeah.
But I was looking at, you know, Fairfax Financial Holdings or News Corp. Those are still small caps?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think we have to define small cap as defined by MSCI, right? So it's the top of the index. So technically, you know, when we're looking at new ideas, we are investing kind of below the top end of the index. The index is, you know, it fluctuates, but the top end tends to be about 10, 12 billion, right? So the sweet spot for us is really that $2 to $5 billion range, right? So when we can find these kind of under, you know, and you know, the point you make is it's kind of by design, right? If you look at the holdings, they're a little eclectic.
Yeah, they are.
They tend to be things that are a little off the run. You probably know a couple. But then you start looking at things like, you know, Kirby would be an example, right? In the top 10, right? And, you know, so Kirby, they they're a barge operator. So 80% of petrochemical production in the United States happens in Texas and Louisiana. And one of the most cost-effective ways to transport petrochemicals is actually you put it on a barge and you run it up the Mississippi River system. Okay. So Turby is, they have about 1,000 barges. The market is about 4,000. So roughly 25% market share. They are, you know, 2.5x the next largest competitor. But barges, you know, they're a cyclical business. And this industry overbuilt in the early 2000s. The great thing is, you know, in cyclical businesses, cyclical industries, supply and demand, they rationalize one another. So the industry got overbuilt. Basically, there's been no new supply added to this industry in 10 years. Okay.
Oh, wait. What's the inflection point? This is like a long drawn out thing.
Yep. So again, now what's happening? You know, capacity utilization ticking above 90%. Suddenly these companies have pricing power. Okay. So if you were to go back and, you know, day rates, so it used to cost about $3 million to build a barge pre-COVID. Day rates needed to be about $8,000 a day to justify building new supply. And something happened. Okay. Price of construction went up. It costs like $4 or $5 million to build a barge now. Required day rates, something like $12,000 to $13,000. Pricing is only at $9,000.
Mm.
Okay. So again, our investment thesis was pricing needs to go up. Return on capital for these businesses needs to inflect significantly higher, and the replacement cost of that fleet is materially higher, right? So that's kind of the inflection point. Industry consolidation, no demand growth or no supply growth has caused, you know, the industry to rationalize, and suddenly you have a business or an industry that didn't have pricing power and now it does.
Yeah, so yeah, and you're anticipating a continued inflection.
Absolutely.
Point.
I mean, you have to anticipate, right? If it's in the numbers, it's in the stock price. So you have to see a future that is different than the market. If you do, you know, if you want to beat the market, you have to do something different than the market. And you need to, you know, so we are always looking at saying, okay, what do I see? What do I see that's different than the market? And more importantly, why is the market going to see things as I see them, you know, 12, 24 months from now?
Some more of your names in the top 10, XPO. What is that?
So again, another example, double inflection point in the stock. XPO is a LTL trucking company. And LTL, so there's two basic types of trucking. So TL is truckload. So if you think of if you're driving on a highway and a transport truck goes by you, that is truckload.
Right.
Okay? LTL is more smaller vans.
Less than truckload.
Less than truckload. So, you know, very specific.
Yeah, I'm good.
A truck that might go from a warehouse to a
Walmart
or something, right? So LTL, there's three large public players, so Old Dominion Freight Lines, Saia, and XPO. And XPO is always the laggard. So then there was an inflection point. So what happened? They got a new management team. So last April, the management team changed. So, and this is very important because the new COO that they got was a man, his name is Dave Bates. And Dave Bates, prior to him joining XPO, was actually the COO at Old Dominion Freight Lines. So think of him as the best operator in the industry, okay? See, and you know, he got passed over to be the CEO, not once but twice, and he finally said, okay, I'm leaving. You know, new opportunity. So you take the best operator at the underperforming business, and we work with our analysts to say, okay, what does success look like? Right. And the answer that our analysts came back with was, you know, we think the earnings can double, and the stock trades at a 30% discount to the group, so the multiple can go up 50%. So think of up 100, up 50, you got the potential for a stock to triple, right? So these are the types of things that we're looking for. And then, you know, so it starts happening, right? He comes in, starts making incremental improvements to the business, and then something else happens. Okay, this is like turbocharged. So you have, you probably remember last summer, Yellow, the trucking company that went bankrupt. So this was a unionized trucking company, had always been the least price disciplined player in the industry. This is industry capacity, you know, rationalization. They go bankrupt. They don't declare Chapter 11, they declare Chapter 7, which means they liquidate. Pricing starts going up. Pricing inflects, so you have new manager, industry pricing inflects, and you know, you have a recipe for profitability to go up significantly in a business. And you see, again, you have to look forward, because if you look back, the future doesn't look so good, right? So you always have to look forward.
Okay, so that's success, the way you define success. Where do you draw the line for failure? Like, what is your sell discipline on both ends? When it doesn't work, or when it does work, when do you get rid of it?
Yeah, I mean, there's three reasons to sell a stock. So, you know, two good reasons, one bad reason. The good reason is you have a thesis, the investment thesis works, and it trades up to what, you know, what we declare fair value. So fair value to us just means, you know, if you think of it as the stock market typically goes up, what, 8 to 10% a year over time. If suddenly we have a stock and it is discounting an 8 to 10% return to us that is fairly valued, it needs to be replaced, right? It's not good enough for us. So we are, you know, that is one reason why it's sell. Two, you just have a better idea. So part of portfolio construction is you have to put together not just, you know, when we're looking at a new idea, it's not just, is this a good idea? Is it something better than what we already own, right? So if we're looking at two industrial ideas, for example, and, you know, or two trucking ideas, right? So if you are looking at a business in the same industry, it's not just, okay, is this good enough to go in the fund? It's got to kick something else out, right? We want to keep the risk, the value at risk in those top 40 to 50 stocks. So if to move into that core, it needs to kick something else out. And if you find a better idea, sometimes you'll just sell something to make room for a better idea. The third reason, you know, and it happens a lot, is you're wrong. You have a thesis, you know, The world's uncertain. You're not always going to be right. And I think that the key is you have to be disciplined and ruthless. And this is what we, you know, I think Chris and I both learned this, you know, from Mark Schmel. You have to be disciplined and ruthless. When your investment thesis is wrong, you sell and you don't invent new reasons to own a stock. I have a saying, the losers average losers. And if you have a losing position and you have, you know, an investment thesis that has been invalidated, you never invent new reasons to own a stock. So you have to be very, very disciplined. Again, going back to that risk budget that we set with every position, you can't invalidate the risk budget.
Okay. We only have a couple of minutes left. Talk to me about volatility in the marketplace. Is this and we're seeing more of it creeping into the marketplace. Do you see this as an opportunity for you right now, Ben?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's hard to predict which areas of the market where that is going to manifest itself and take place. But I think, you know, when there is volatility, turnover tends to go up during periods of volatility. But, you know, if you look at the periods exiting, you know, COVID, exiting the, you know, initial, Ukraine-Russia invasion, you know, I think I always say, like, it never feels good to have, you know, your positions, your fund go down. But I always think of it as, okay, that's just embedded future alpha, right? So we are always using periods of volatility to high grade the portfolio, right? So when there are dislocations, we can then high grade into better ideas and the opportunities that are getting presented to us. So we always use that volatility to, you know, ask ourselves, where is the next opportunity, right? It could be macro volatility. It could be industry volatility. Sometimes it's like, you know, you have operational volatility at companies, right? Sometimes companies just screw up. Yeah. And you get the opportunity to buy great business at a great business, temporary but fixable problem.
Right? So what's your turnover like? Because if you're limiting yourself to 40 or 50 stocks, you would think you're high conviction stocks.
Yeah.
What is your turnover?
It's about trailing 12 months. I think it's like 61%, something like that.
61?
Okay. So, you know, we're turning the portfolio. But the thing that you got to realize is part of that, it's kind of bifurcated. So we have companies that we've owned for 4.5 years since, you know, the strategy started in 2019. We're also, you know, we keep things on a tight leash, right? If we have an investment thesis and it's not working, we are going to sell. So again, it's really, okay, concentrate on the winners, concentrate on what is working, and be very, you know, hyper-vigilant on where you have an investment thesis and it's not working, right? And so I think, you know, we have, you know, some holdings have been there for 3-4 years and others, you know, maybe you have a thesis and, you know, either like the fundamentals don't work or management, you know, does something you don't like, and you lose faith or you lose trust in them, and then you move on, right? But we're always, okay, focus on the winners.
30 seconds. Why should they have your product in their portfolios?
Yeah, look, I think, three reasons, right? I think, you know, first is enhance your opportunity set. I think if you're a Canadian investor and you're only investing in Canadian equities, you only see 5% of the opportunity set, right? Even if you go to the US, you're only going to see 50% of the opportunity set. So our view is do not pigeonhole yourselves. Use, you know, a global mandate, a global universe to enhance your overall opportunity set to get those stocks into your client portfolios. Second one, as I said, can be a nice, great diversifier, right? So, you know, global, small cap, and, you know, again, consumer, industrials, financials, I think we can be that great complement to a core equity allocation. And lastly, you know, I think we've demonstrated that we can be a great return enhancer for an overall client portfolio. Use that global universe, use that inefficient asset class to really add returns, add alpha to a client portfolio.
Connor, thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. Fidelity Mutual Funds and ETFs are available by working with a financial advisor or through an online brokerage account. Visit fidelity.ca/howtobuy for more information. While visiting fidelity.ca, you can also find information on future live webcasts. And don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and LinkedIn. Thanks again. See you next time. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada, ULC, or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy or endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.